Let's move on now then to look at some of the social factors in the time of Christ, which I think are important. First of all, taxation. Taxation was a real problem for many Jews. Now, some people have given tremendously high figures of 60 and 70% taxation at this time, and Blomberg in page 61 talks about this issue. Michael McClymond, in his book Familiar Stranger on the Life of Christ, has a combined figure of 35% for taxes. He also states that as the temple tax was a free will offering, that it often suffered, especially in years of lean production. Taxes generally were the Roman taxes that were put on them, and then the taxes that were brought about by, for example, Herod Antipas's building projects. People were taxed. They would be taxed on money, but they were also taxed on grains and so on and so forth as well. And so it could be a real pull and strain on the finances, particularly as the elders and the families and so on, and the Herodian families, would buy up the lands. And therefore they would marginalize the abilities of the peasants to actually make a living. You know, this was part of the reason why there was so much dislike of the Herods and the Herodians, a kind of a loose group, probably to be identified with the more wealthy landowners, of course, Jesus spoke about in his parables, who would basically be supporting Herod and the status quo, as we've seen. The Herodians shouldn't be seen really as a religious factor, but those who supported, particularly the Sadducees and so on, but were not necessarily religious. So there was high taxes at this time, and of course then the tax collectors, who seem to have been all over the place at this time, they made their livings by not only charging the taxes, but then extracting more money from the people than the authorities actually were asking for. That's how they made their living. As far as social structures and social classes, there was certainly a class structure in Israel at this time. In Galilee, the more prosperous Jewish landowners who had sided with the authorities, and again, we think that the Herodians probably came from this group, they lived in and around the two more Hellenized cities of Sepphoris and Tiberias, particularly Tiberias, and therefore they would be absentee landlords often. Sepphoris, as we've said, was just a few miles away from Nazareth and could be seen from there. It was being rebuilt by Antipas during the 20s AD when Jesus was growing up. Tiberias was a new city on the shores of the Sea of Galilee and was built on the site of an ancient graveyard. Antipas had to force Jews to live there very often because they didn't want anything to do with that town. And Paul Barnett, in his book Behind the Scenes of the New Testament, says this: the wealthy Galilean landowners and members of the Herod family lived in or near the two cities of Sepphoris and Tiberias. Sepphoris was on the next hill 3 miles to the north of Nazareth and clearly visible to it. Tiberias was on the Sea of Galilee, half a day's walk from Nazareth. So again, you're talking about, again, not very far, really. These landowners were an elite group, socially remote from the Galilean peasants. The ordinary people from the Galilean towns and villages, however, had as little as possible to do with the cities of the aristocracy. So you can see that there was a definite divide between these individuals. Now, just a word on Nazareth while we're on the subject here. And I want to give you a little quotation here from Barnett's book. While there is no reference in literature to Nazareth prior to Jesus, travelers from distant places would often have been seen in its streets. Greek-speaking visitors, for example, must have passed through the village. A few years after Jesus, while Claudius was emperor, AD 41 to AD 54, a Greek inscription was erected in Nazareth forbidding the removal of bodies from tombs. Here's the quotation. "It is my pleasure that sepulchres and tombs, which have been erected as solemn memorials of ancestors, of children or relatives, shall remain undisturbed in perpetuity. If it be shown that anyone has either destroyed them or removed them with malicious intent to another place, thus committing a crime against those buried there, or removed the headstones, I command against such person the same sentences be passed in respect of solemn memorials of men as is laid down in respect of the gods. Much rather must one pay respect to those who are buried. Let no one disturb them on any account. Otherwise, it is my will that capital sentence be passed upon such person for the crime of tomb spoliation." And you can see, therefore, that they were, again, very interested, the Herods and the rulers there, that they didn't upset the Jews from these towns. And then he goes on and says, "Scholars have wondered why this edict prohibiting the removal of bodies from graves should be preserved only in Nazareth. Were attempts made to find the body of Jesus, and so rebut claims that he had risen from the dead, leaving the tomb in Jerusalem empty? Apart from that interesting possibility, the significance of this inscription in Nazareth is that it is in Greek. Clearly, some people at Nazareth were presumed able to read it." And so again, this ties in with the fact that although Nazareth was a town that was thoroughly Jewish, yet because it was close to Sepphoris, and because, of course, Gentiles, Galilee was called Galilee of the Gentiles, lived there and trafficked there, that many people in Nazareth would speak Greek. And that is worth noting. The languages, going on to that, it's interesting to look at the languages that were used at this time, since there is a debate about which language Jesus spoke in during his ministry years. Dunn thinks he would have mainly spoken Aramaic, and Blomberg does too, and I think he probably would when he was dealing with people in, you know, day-to-day life. But it is very possible that some Greek speeches have come down to us. Blomberg says that on page 12. And in view of that, I want to just quote a little here from both Barnett on page 42 in relation to the languages of Jesus. He says, and this is his book again, Behind the Scenes of the New Testament, he says that in his dealings with the Greek Syro-Phoenician woman in Mark 7:26, he says this is often seen as evidence that Jesus could speak Greek. His use of the word hypocrite or play actor is thought also to indicate his familiarity with the Greek language. Plays were forbidden to the Jews. The word hypocrite does not appear in Hebrew or Aramaic. Some scholars suggest that when Jesus addressed Galilean crowds, he spoke Greek. They point out that on the few occasions Jesus' Aramaic words are recorded, they occur in private conversations where the language of the home would have been more appropriate. Mark 5:4, Mark 7:34. His reference to Mammon, apparently spoken to a crowd, is an exception in Matthew 6:26. And then just following on that, McClymond, in his book Familiar Stranger, which is a basic life of Jesus, very well written, although a bit liberal, like Dunn. I don't fully recommend these books. But McClymond says this on pages 51 and 52. And again, forgive the quotation, but I think it's better for me to quote from the source on this particular matter. He says, "While virtually no contemporary scholars have argued that Jesus spoke only Greek, a number of writers have concluded that Jews in first century Palestine used Greek extensively. Perhaps a majority of them spoke Greek. Many Jews even chose Greek for memorializing the dead in their burial inscriptions. that even rabbis and their families phrased their epitaphs in Greek strongly indicates that Greek was the language of their daily life. Without question, Greek was the lingua franca, or common language of the Roman Empire as a whole. Stanley Porter writes, quote, Galilee was completely surrounded by Hellenistic culture, with Acho Ptolemais, Tyre and Sidon in the west and northwest, Panias Caesarea Philippi, Hippos and Gadara in the northeast, east to southeast, Scythopolis and Garba in the south. Besides being connected by a number of waterways, there was a road system that utilized a series of valleys to interconnect the Galilean region. As a result, Galilee was a center for import and export, as well as general trade, resulting in a genuinely cosmopolitan flavor. Now, we do have to say that the Jews in Galilee, nevertheless, though they had this cosmopolitan connection, they observed the Jewish rites, and there were lots and lots of mikvahs, the ceremonial baths that are found in many houses and many villages in Galilee, showing that they really were interested in Jewish observance. He continues on page 52. Capernaum, a town of 12,000 to 15,000, was yet more culturally diverse than Nazareth. Matthew, perhaps also known as Levi, I would say definitely known as Levi, the tax collector in Capernaum, would probably have used Greek and would have had to use Greek to converse with the local taxpayers and the officials of Herod Antipas. The fishermen disciples would also probably have needed to speak Greek in order to carry on their business of selling fish. And so it does seem that there's a good case for the fact that Greek was very often used. I think, yes, Aramaic was the normal discourse in the households, but when it came to public teaching and so on, it is very possible that Jesus spoke Greek in addressing the crowds and they understood what he was saying. We should also note that Jews are found with Greek names and vice versa. Greeks found with Jewish names. So again, it helps to encourage this understanding of the two being interconnected. When one considers that there was a Greek-speaking synagogue in Jerusalem, and that many Jews, particularly those pilgrims who lived outside the land, used the Septuagint translation, and that it appears that the writers of the New Testament employed the Septuagint translation quite a lot, not all the time, but quite a lot, then one gets the idea of the importance of the Greek language. Latin was not used very much outside the Roman camps and official enclaves. Most Romans and all officials spoke Greek. It is almost certain that Pilate's interview with Jesus in John 19, 18 and 19, for example, was in Greek. The common tongue of the Jews was Aramaic, and no doubt Jesus would speak Aramaic often. Hebrew was employed in the reading of the law and in the rabbinic schools. And Jesus, because he was invited, of course, to be a teacher, would have spoken Hebrew as well. Paul addresses, it seems, the crowds in Hebrew, or at least in Aramaic, in the book of Acts as well. He would have certainly known Hebrew as a Pharisee scholar. And so that gives us a basic background then to the Gospels. There's much more that could be said. Blomberg, you are to read to give you more background as well. But hopefully that gives us a basic setting for the study of the Gospels as a whole.